State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Kadish presiding.
Go ahead and have a seat, everybody. All right. So we are on calendar this morning for argument on 84991, Nevada Hospital Association et al. Versus State of Nevada et al. Is everybody ready?
Yes, sir.
All right, then. I think we did get that order out on the Pro Hoc application. So, all right.
Thank you.
So it's 15 minutes per side. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may.
Okay, and so what's going to happen is you're just going to get the yellow light and a tone at 5 minutes, but the clock's going to keep running down.
Yes,
ma'am. If you stand there, your time keeps running.
I understand. It's on me. I understand. Okay. Thank you.
All right, go ahead.
Good morning, and may it please the court. James Burnham here on behalf of the appellants. SB 329 is an extraordinary state intervention into the private contracts between hospital networks and the large insurance companies that fund patient care. And it's one that threatens to degrade health care throughout the Western United States and indeed the nation. Our submission is that it therefore likely violates the Dormant Commerce Clause. But the court does not need to resolve that weighty question today. The only question before the court right now is a much more narrow and much more preliminary question, and that's simply whether my clients should have an opportunity to compile the factual record required to substantiate the claim I made at the beginning that this law violates the Dormant Commerce Clause. They clearly should. Under Nevada's pleading standards, dismissal is appropriate provided notice has been given to the defendants of the claim only when it is beyond a doubt that there is no set of facts that could prove that could substantiate the claim. And as our briefs explain, there's indeed a very compelling argument that SB 329's substantial interstate burdens far exceed its local benefits.
Mr. Burnham, could you address the point that the complaint did not sufficiently plead the Dormant Commerce Clause allegations?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. So I think there's sort of two steps to the analysis. The first is whether notice was given of what the claim was, and then the second is the no set of facts inquiry that I alluded to. On the notice side of the equation, I think it's pretty clear the complaint gave notice. There were 9 full paragraphs pleading the Dormant Commerce Clause. That's paragraphs 120 to 134. It was discussed at length in the briefing. The defendants briefed and litigated the Dormant Commerce Clause.
I think you misspoke. It's 120 to 128.
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor. You're right. That's a typo in my...
That's fine. Go
yes.
ahead.
But the defendants, in any event, the defendants briefed and litigated the Dormant Commerce Clause. They raised the Pike claim. The oppositions to the motion to dismiss discussed them as well. And the district court...
There is the Pike claim alleged in those 8 paragraphs.
The case,
however made.
No, certainly, Your Honor. The case Pike is not cited in the complaint. The complaint cites the Dormant Commerce Clause, which is the broader doctrinal.
Sure. You don't have to cite cases in your complaint.
Yes, ma'am.
But where are the factual allegations that support a Pike claim?
So I would submit that under the notice pleading standard, we just had to give the defendants notice that we were bringing a Dormant Commerce Clause claim.
So all you need is heading Dormant Commerce Clause and one paragraph that says we're alleging this claim.
Your Honor, I think you need a little more than that. You need to have it be clear what the law is that you're attacking and what sort of the gravamen of the complaint is. And I think it was clear, and the defendants knew it was clear, because in their motion... Sorry, Your Honor.
So I understand the first part of that from the complaint, but where in the complaint is the second part? Right? What are the facts that support a Dormant Commerce Clause claim, because I am struggling to see that.
Right. So as I understand the way the standard operates, notice is what I was talking about before, which is did they understand what the claim we were bringing was? And then the no set of facts inquiry is not something that's confined to the four corners of the complaint. So the four corners of the complaint simply have to give notice. And then at that point, it's a general inquiry into whether this claim could have teeth. Because if you had to plead all the things that show no set of facts, or sorry, that there is a set of facts, then I think it would start to collapse back into the federal standard that this court has held time and again is a different and higher standard.
Well, you at least need to plead facts to satisfy the elements of the claim you're asserting.
So I would suggest, Your Honor, that as long as the defendants are on notice of the claim that you're bringing, and they understand the general contours. And if you look at all the filings below, it's very clear everyone understood what was going on. Indeed, the district court adjudicated the case on the basis of a Pike claim. Then I think there was sufficient notice, and then we can move on to the no set of facts inquiry. If you look at the district court's opinion itself, the district judge understood that we were bringing a Pike claim, and that's the basis on which the court dismissed it. Now, it made errors.
What are the facts that support that claim?
In general or in the complaint?
Either.
Oh, well, in general, I think it's everything we've canvassed in our briefing. And I think there's substantial basis to conclude that SB 329 might violate the Dormant Commerce Clause, which is all we have to show at the pleading stage. And so I'm happy to go through that. So the discount for volume bargain is essentially the economic foundation of the American healthcare system. Hospitals have extremely high fixed costs. It's very expensive to maintain MRI machines, hospital facilities, and all of that. That requires economy of scale and substantial patient volume. One of the problems hospitals have is that many of the patients, those that are on government insurance programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and certainly those that are uninsured, are loss leaders for the hospital.
So the fact that Nevada hospitals who do business in Nevada might be adversely affected by a Nevada law, how does that violate the Dormant Commerce Clause?
Your Honor, framed that way, I don't think it does. I think what makes it a plausible Dormant Commerce Clause claim is that these hospital systems are regional and national. And so the economics are all interrelated. So if Nevada does something that basically makes it impossible for hospitals to be sustainable in Nevada, it not only degrades care in Nevada, it degrades care out of state. So when the hospitals have to react to this law, they do a variety of things. So if they have less revenue, they have less money for investment. That's not just investment in Nevada, that's investment in California and Arizona and everywhere else that these hospital chains operate. They have to cut services. And so again, that's not just cutting services here. They have to cut services in rural areas and poor areas to keep the entire business afloat. Just because the business operates hospitals in Nevada, Nevada's not hermetically sealed from the interstate nature of these businesses. One of the other things the hospitals have to do, and this has already started happening, is my understanding, and we'd like a chance to prove this on remand, is they have to cut services. They have to cut mental health services. They have to cut maternity services.
Are there mental health services? Oh, sorry, we'll deal with that a different day.
I think we can all agree that we should have mental health services.
Yes, I do agree with that.
At this time in this country. And so the last thing we need is something that causes hospitals to cut those services out of state. See, one of the problems and one of the things that I think we'd like to be able to prove on remand is that when Nevada passes a law that changes the economic structure of the hospitals here, it basically shifts a lot of those costs out of state as well. And so you can't just look at it as though it's in a bubble. You have to look at the entire thing system wide. And I think if you look at the benefits of the law, you see this even more clearly. I mean, one of the things that the state has suggested is that this is going to save money for consumers. But I think it's much more likely that it'll just be a bonanza for insurance companies.
Aren't these policy arguments for the legislature? Like, it's not for us to decide, is this a smart law or not a smart law?
I completely agree with that, Your Honor, except to the extent that the U.S. Constitution requires you to engage in the Pike balancing policy analysis. So what the Supreme Court has said time and again, and this court has recognized as much too in cases like Douglas Disposal, is that if you have a Pike claim, the court does have to engage in a limited policy analysis. And the reason that it does that is because the Constitution's purpose under the Commerce Clause is to protect the national economy. So we don't just rely on the Nevada legislature to look out for the interests of people in California, Arizona, Utah, and elsewhere. We understand that sometimes legislatures, quite understandably, will look out for the best interests of their state, perhaps at the expense of other states. And so that's why the courts have to engage in this inquiry. But
the plaintiffs here aren't like out-of-state businesses who are saying you're unduly burdening us from doing business in Nevada. They're Nevada entities doing business here. Like, I don't even understand how this is a Dormant Commerce Clause claim.
So we're not arguing it on the discrimination point, which I think is what the first half of your question was channeling. We're arguing it purely on a burden point, which in the Supreme Court's recent pork producers decision, 6 of the 9 justices said is a perfectly valid way of bringing a Commerce Clause claim. I can actually give you the citations.
Sure. But then what in the complaint alleges what you'll have to show under that Pike test, which is that the burden on interstate commerce is clearly excessive in relation to the putative local benefits? Like, what in the complaint alleges facts that, if proven, would establish that?
Yeah, so it's an excellent question. I think my best answer to that is the complaint cleared the low bar of providing notice of the claim and the nature of the claim. We know this as a factual matter because everyone engaged on the claim. And then we filed other materials below at the same time, declarations attached to the preliminary injunction motion, et cetera, that very clearly channel the arguments I'm making now, just to give you one.
So you've now pointed to everything but the complaint.
Well, so as I understand the law in this state, and I mean, Your Honor certainly knows Nevada law better than I do, but as I understand the rule, you give notice, and that's enough, and then the district court has to engage in a broader inquiry under the no set of facts standard.
The motion for preliminary injunction and the complaint filed together, correct?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
So both were before the court, and indeed it resolved them both in a single order.
That's right, Your Honor.
And you're only appealing the denial of the,
that's correct,
the granting of the motion to
dismiss. Yes, Your Honor. All we're asking the court to do is let us build a record. Yeah, please. If you had another
question. That's fine.
Yes, that's exactly right. All we're appealing is the dismissal, and all we're asking for is a chance to build an evidentiary record to support this claim. And I think that's manifestly fair because everyone understood the claim below, and indeed the declarations that I was alluding to talk about the interstate burdens and how it's burdening the nationwide hospital networks and all the things we've talked about today. If there's no further questions, I'd love to save the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. For the record, Kevin Powers, LCB Legal Division, representing the legislature of the state of Nevada. With me today is Sabrina Clinton, the Deputy Attorney General, representing the state of Nevada also, and the Governor and the Attorney General, and also Nathaniel Rulis, who's representing Health Services Coalition. I'll be arguing for the first 12 minutes. Mr. Rulis will take over the remaining 3 minutes, if that's what's left when I'm done. Plaintiffs' complaint fails under all standards, regardless of how low the bar is. The bar is not so low in Nevada that you don't have to plead any facts. Notice pleading does not mean no facts. The plaintiffs had full opportunity in the district court to present the facts to support their Commerce Clause claim. Those facts weren't in the original complaint. The same 9 paragraphs that you see in the First Amendment complaint were in the original complaint. No facts in the original complaint, no facts in the First Amendment complaint. In the motion for preliminary injunction, the plaintiffs didn't even argue their Commerce Clause claim. They didn't feel it was a valid claim enough to argue in their motion for preliminary injunction. Then, in response to the legislature's motion to dismiss, the plaintiffs filed a counter motion to amend their complaint, and they attached a proposed second amended complaint. In that proposed second amended complaint, plaintiffs did not change any of their paragraphs for the Commerce Clause. They added no additional facts. What has happened here is that the plaintiffs have abandoned all constitutional claims that they raised in the district court, which there was like 4 or 5 other claims, and are now relying on their dormant Commerce Clause claim. And they're trying to use their appellate brief to fill in the facts that they didn't present in their First Amended complaint, in their motion for preliminary injunction, and in their proposed Second Amended complaint. Simply put, the plaintiffs have failed any bar, regardless of how low that bar is. This is also reinforced by the fact that although Nevada is a notice pleading state, this is a federal claim. So Nevada can't ignore federal precedent dealing with Commerce Clause claims. In this case, we have 2 cases that are very significant.
Are you suggesting, counsel, then, that we need to follow the federal law with respect to pleading the claim?
We're not arguing that, but it's something the court can consider. Obviously, in other cases, plaintiffs have asked this court to adopt the federal claim for pleading requirements. We're not asking.
Defendants have asked that we adopt the more rigorous review of Iqbal and Twombly, but we have not. I mean, Nevada has been pretty steadfast in holding to the pre-Iqbal Twombly standard.
That's correct, and we're not arguing for the court to change the standard here today. If the court did want to change the standards here today, we would recommend that you order additional briefing on that issue and put this case before the full en banc court in order to make such a significant change in Nevada law. But we're not arguing that. We're saying even under Nevada's notice pleading requirements, this complaint fails because there are absolutely no facts.
But the order itself, which it looks as though your office drafted, really engages completely on the merits and treats the preliminary injunction and its factual allegations, and they're proven by affidavits, it treats those as interchangeable. This was not a classic, this complaint under any stretch of any imagination and any inference in favor of the plaintiff fails. It was on the merits, this dormant commerce clause and other claims fail.
Well, I think
so to what extent does that put us in a position of reviewing what the district court considered?
And you can review what the district court considered and still come to the same conclusion that there's not sufficient facts. The district court has a job to find the law, and that's what the district court did. It set forth the law of dormant commerce clause. Then the district court concluded that the complaint didn't have any support in order to find a district find a commerce clause violation under that existing law. The plaintiffs are asking that because the district court cited Pike, that did their job for them. They don't have to cite any additional facts because the district court cited Pike. But the district court always has to rely on the law. The district court can find the law on its own. The plaintiff has a duty to present the facts. Two cases here in federal...
Mr. Powers, on a 12B5 motion, at least, if resolving a 12B5 motion, you wouldn't expect a district court to be finding facts about what, in this case, what the interstate impact was, if at all, what the local benefit was, if at all. Aren't those usually facts that are not addressed or found at the motion to dismiss stage?
Well, I think what the district court did is rely on the presumption of constitutionality. When a complaint fails to allege facts, then the district court presumes that the complaint fails to meet the Pike test because it's presumed constitutional. That's all the district court did here. It found no facts and then concluded that the plaintiff failed to meet the Pike standard, that there was, you know, the plaintiff has to establish that there was no legitimate interest. Without facts, the district court has to presume there is.
That isn't really how the order reads. As Justice Pickering said, that it's an analysis of the statute as it applies in this case, right? So this court also concludes that the challenge provisions do not impose any burden on interstate commerce that is clearly excessive in relation to the putative local benefits of prohibitions against anti-competitive contractual provisions. I mean, how do you come to that conclusion without looking at any facts?
Well, you come to the conclusion because there are no facts, you presume it's constitutional. But the court determines that constitutionality by saying the Pike test hasn't been met. The court is saying, no facts, we presume then that there's a legitimate interest, and that legitimate interest doesn't clearly outweigh the burden on interstate commerce. That's where the presumption kicks in. And the district court order clearly lays out all the presumptions for the constitutionality of legislation. I think the key here for the court is you have to look at the two national pork product cases, the one in the Ninth Circuit and the one for the U.S. Supreme Court. At least four justices in the Supreme Court one determined that a complaint that had a lot of facts failed to meet the federal pleading standard. This complaint has no facts. But even though that you don't have a five-justice majority in national pork products, you have a plurality, and that's persuasive authority, and this court should follow that persuasive authority. But in addition, because you have five justices who affirm the Ninth Circuit, that Ninth Circuit decision is binding on federal courts in the Ninth Circuit. And we're asking this court to rule consistently with the national pork product decision as determined by the Ninth Circuit. So you don't have different laws on this in Nevada and the Ninth Circuit, because all you're going to get then is forum shopping. Plaintiffs are going to come to Nevada if all they have to do is cite the Commerce Clause in their complaint. And then you put the state in a difficult position of removing the case to federal court, but potentially waiving the 11th Amendment immunity of the state.
Mr. Powers, the federal court under Erie applies state substantive law, but the inverse, though, when we have cases in the state court follows state procedure and federal substantive law. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely correct. But in order to apply the notice pleading requirement, you have to know what facts are necessary to meet the substantive law.
Right.
And National Pork Products tells us what the substantive law is that you need facts to establish that there's a true burden on interstate commerce, and those facts need to be in the complaint.
Well, but would you agree with me that if we consider the affidavits that were submitted in support of the preliminary injunction, that they sufficiently establish a dormant commerce clause claim for purposes of the pleading standard?
We disagree with that. We don't think the complaints are enough, because if you compare the pork product case...
You mean the affidavit.
The affidavit, sorry. The affidavits. If you compare the pork product cases, they had plenty of factual support, affidavits and other facts establishing how California's statute affected the entire national pork industry, and it affected a significant...
But don't those affidavits establish that because these are nationally operating, you're going to crater the economic model in other states in order to have them comply with this Nevada law? Because they're, as I understand it, and it's not intuitive to me, but as I understand it, I had the same reaction as Justice Kadish originally, like this seems like the opposite of a Dormant Commerce Clause claim. But their affidavits do establish that they're operating nationally, and that if you sink out Nevada so it is now more expensive, you're going to penalize people elsewhere from the existing practice and efficiency.
My answer is two-part. First, there was 9 justices in pork products who rejected the extraterritorial effects argument that the plaintiffs want to present. The pork producer said that because of the huge cost of changing the pork production nationally to comply with California standards, that those extraterritorial effects were per se a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause, or they violated Pike. All 9 justices rejected that. Also, in addition to that, you have a situation here where Exxon versus Governor of Maryland comes into play. And there the Supreme Court said simply additional compliance costs and effects on the industry are not enough to create a Commerce Clause violation. That's all they're arguing here, that there's going to be additional compliance costs in Nevada, and they say nationwide as well. But that extraterritorial effect is not sufficient under pork products. All 9 justices determined that.
But aren't they arguing impact on human beings elsewhere and businesses?
And that's where you got the split of law in the pork products decision. You had 4 justices say that those costs on human beings were not enough to survive a motion to dismiss in pork products. You had 4 justices that said, yes, that was enough to go beyond the motion to dismiss stage. And then you had Justice Barrett in concurrence, who I'm not even going to comment on what she did. No, I'm just kidding, Your Honors. She obviously concluded that Pike shouldn't exist at all. And that's certainly one of the, 2 of the other justices thought Pike shouldn't exist at all. We're not asking the court to go down that road. The bottom line is that there are not sufficient justices at the federal level in the U.S. Supreme Court to establish the extraterritorial effects argument that plaintiffs are making. Whether there's human costs, whether there's compliance costs, that's not federal law. So there are no set of facts that they could plead to establish an extraterritorial violation that they're claiming here. And I believe that covers everything I need to discuss, unless there's any other questions that the justices have. And so, Mr. Rulis, you got lucky. You get 340.
Good morning, Your Honors. Nathaniel Rulis on behalf of Defendants in Intervention Health Services Coalition. And I think...
Can you just remind me what, in fact, your client entity is?
Sure. My client is a coalition of essentially self-insured groups. And so they represent things like, or they have included in them among unions and casino workers that go through the self-insured groups and then negotiate, as insurers, negotiate with the hospitals on this. And so, when we talk about, when appellants come in here and talk about, frankly, new issues on appeal, things like discount for volume and that sort of thing, the reality is that's not happening. In the 2 years, almost 2 years, since this law has been enacted, it's been business as usual for my clients. It continues to be the same. But going back to what we're talking about here, which is the pleading standard, and Your Honors were asking, I think, the right questions and on the right thing. If you go to the complaint in this case, there are no set of facts alleged at all as far as the Dormant Commerce Clause goes. If you go through paragraphs 120 through 128, which are, by the way, the only paragraphs that appellants cited to in arguments before the district court that were, they say, sufficient to get past the motion to dismiss. In fact, if you go to their briefing, their oppositions to the motion to dismiss, the only paragraphs they cite to are paragraphs 120 and 121. And if you look at that, 120 is essentially a reference to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution. That's their site in case law. And 121 is a flat legal conclusion. There are no facts alleged to support them. So when your honors were asking, is this essentially, are you asking that this is just, all I have to do is say dormant commerce clause and I get to the summary judgment stage? That's essentially the request that is before the court. That as long as they say dormant commerce clause, they don't have to allege anything else to get past the motion to dismiss stage. And that is not what the law in Nevada is. And that's what, we talked about it in our reply brief. You have Johnson versus Travelers Insurance that specifically says you have to allege facts in your complaint to support the claims that are being alleged. They haven't done that here.
If this were a rational basis review, how would they allege it under your theory?
I don't think they could. I mean,
I'm not applying that to this law, but I think they're kind of in that mixed area where a conclusion of law can also serve to be an allegation that they're trying to trigger a constitutional analysis. I get that this is more fact-bound than rational basis review, but it strikes me that this complaint is kind of in that ballpark.
Well, and I think the issue with this is, and even in the, if you go to the affidavits that were submitted with the motion for preliminary injunction, what we have is not facts. What we have are speculation and what might be. Even Mr. Burnham here today is saying what might happen. You don't have facts to support this because they don't exist. And that's what, when you get back to, and what Mr. Burnham's saying is there any factual basis out there that could support these claims? And there's not. They can't allege it because it doesn't exist. All they have is speculation and conclusory allegations, and that's not sufficient under Nevada.
Thank you, Your Honors. One quick clarification for Justice Pickering. The PI was 1 month after the complaint, but it was all litigated together. So I just wanted to make sure I didn't mistake
that.
Thank you.
I thought they were filed simultaneously.
They're
that was my
very
question.
Close, and it was all briefed and decided together. First, I would not change this court's longstanding pleading standard just for this case. And in fact, I would direct the court to Douglas Disposal, which, as luck would have it, is a dormant commerce clause case. And in that case, this court said, quote, Disposal had notice of the constitutional arguments and was thereafter able to fully argue the merits of them. And on that basis, this court went on to consider the merits. In that case, the plaintiff, or the person, in, it was a kind of confusing procedural posture, but the dormant commerce clause invoker lost. Obviously, we would like to win. But on this procedural point, I think it is a very useful guide to what is required at the pleading stage. All that's before the court really is the district court's order, which for reasons that have been discussed was plainly in error. The district court found facts. It did not apply the right standard by any measure, not even the defendant's attempt to defend the way the district court disposed of our complaint. And so I think it would be sufficient, quite honestly, for the court to just say, look, you can't find facts against the plaintiff when you're in a motion to dismiss posture. Oh, please, Your Honor.
Well, sure, but on a 12B5 motion being granted and coming up on appeal, we have de novo review. So
certainly
we can apply the standard correctly and evaluate the pleading.
No, I certainly agree, Your Honor. I just think it's telling for the analysis that the district court's analysis was plainly erroneous and that nobody's defending it now. And so we would be affirming in that circumstance on an utterly different basis than the one the court used. We've talked a lot about the National Pork Producers case. I just want to be clear. That case really didn't change the law at all. And if you go through the various opinions, it's pretty darn clear that it didn't. Justice Sotomayor is a controlling vote in the majority opinion, and she wrote for herself, and I think Justice Kagan, and said there's, quote, no fundamental reworking of the doctrine. My colleague was talking about the extraterritorial effects. That's not the point we're making. We're talking about extraterritorial burdens versus in-state benefits. And even the majority opinion by Justice Gorsuch, when he's writing for an actual majority, not when it's a plurality, said, quote, we left the courtroom door open to even non-discriminatory burdens. So I just don't think there's much question that the law today is the same as it was before either of the pork producers cases, and that this court should just apply the sort of standard Pike analysis as we've explicated it in our briefing.
Mr. Burnham, I'm
yes,
a little
ma'am.
Bit confused about something. So the only fact that I can really ascertain from the complaint is paragraph 123 that says the offending provision of SB 329 finding that the only side to the transaction has committed a crime or is in violation, I think it should be one side, committed a crime or is in violation of the stated purpose is not severable. But as I understand what you said earlier and from the briefing, you're not pursuing that particular issue anymore.
We are not pursuing the sort of one-sided crime point. We're only pursuing the Dormant Commerce Clause claim. And I think the best paragraph for that point in this complaint is paragraph 121, where we alleged that because SB 329 unduly burdens interstate commerce, then it does violate the Dormant Commerce Clause. I think that's the paragraph that made clear we were invoking the Pike benefits burdens sort of doctrine, which again, as I say, the defendants knew that that was what we were doing because they all briefed that. I'm sorry, if you have a question.
It's okay. Well, it's just that's, you specifically point in the complaint to that one provision of the statute.
Sorry, yeah. So we had multiple theories below for why it violated the Dormant Commerce Clause, which of course is permitted.
But are not in the complaint.
No, so I think the complaint clearly signals the burden-benefit analysis. I think paragraph 121 can only be read to do that, particularly taking the inferences in our favor. I mean, it's clearly what it's invoking. I think paragraph 122 is making a different point in service.
Is it alleged somewhere that there's a clearly excessive burden on interstate commerce?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I think taking the inferences in our favor, unduly burdens interstate commerce can be fairly read to mean that we're invoking the doctrine that requires a clearly excessive burden. I think especially when you read all the filings below together, which I would suggest is the appropriate inquiry because that's what gave notice to the defendants and the district court, it's very clear that that's what we were alleging below. Your Honor, listen, we are not asking the court to find that this law violates the Dormant Commerce Clause. We're not asking you to agree with all of our broader claims. All we're asking for is a day in court to build an evidentiary record to substantiate the serious damage or our allegations of the serious damage that this law will do to the national economy.
I have a question. May I ask it?
Go ahead.
In brief, what is your Dormant Commerce Clause claim?
Sure. So
you're currently pressing, apart from everything in district court.
Right. It is a purely a Pike balancing claim. So we would say that the local benefits are marginal, the interstate and national burdens are substantial. And there's a less invasive or less burdensome way for the state to achieve its policy objectives. So I forget the name of the case. If I can find it, I'll tell you. It's definitely in our briefs. Oh, it's Cassell, which is
We're interested in the factual statement. Like I'm trying to get at, if you had had this in your complaint, what would you have said?
Oh, certainly. We would have said the following on the burden side. The interstate burdens are that this will create less investment. It will lead hospitals to cut services. It will lead to higher prices. It will lead to consolidation, and it will lead to worse care, not just in Nevada, but throughout everywhere that our hospital clients operate. A lot of these are national and regional chains. If you look at the renowned graphic in our brief, you can see right along the border of California and Nevada. People, when they need to go to the hospital, don't think about what state they're in. They just go to the hospital. And so you can't think about Nevada healthcare as some sort of insulated, you know, sort of hermetically sealed organism, because the businesses that provide it are interstate. The insurance companies are also interstate.
Isn't healthcare an area where states have plenary authority to regulate locally?
I wouldn't say plenary. I would agree with Your Honor, they have substantial authority. And I think that's an issue that will need to get litigated when we have a proper factual record. And we're not resisting the notion that the legislature gets deference or that this is something where they have particular authority. We're just saying this is a very serious law. It's only the second in the nation of its kind. It has a dramatic effect on healthcare. And I think we should be able to build a factual record so this court can make a decision based on the evidence about whether it's constitutional. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right,
I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you. This matter will stand submitted. We'll be in recess until the next call.